Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. This is the Economic and Business History Channel. My name is Paula de la Cruz Fernandez, and I'm a host on this channel. Today, I talk to Dr. Victoria Basualdo, who is a researcher at the Argentine National Scientific Council, CONICET, and at the area of economics and technology of the Facultad Latinoamericana de Ciencias Sociales, FLACSO, and also professor in the Political Economy Master's Degree Program at FLACSO, Argentina. She specializes in contemporary economic and labor history, with a special focus on structural changes and the transformations of trade union organizations in Argentina and Latin America. She authored several chapters and articles on this on the issue of corporate responsibility in human and in human rights violations, and was one of the coordinators of the book Responsabilidad empresarial en delitos de lesa humanidad, represión a trabajadores durante el terrorismo de Estado in 2015. And we are also joined by Dr. Marcelo Buccelli, Associate Professor of Business Administration at the Gies College of Business at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in the United States. His research focuses on the political economy of multinational corporations in Latin America, the theoretical and methodological approaches to the study of the relationship between firms and states in a historical perspective, and also he studies business groups. Both Victoria and Marcelo, along with Hartmut Berthoff, who is the director of the Institute for Economic and Social History at the University of Göttingen in Germany, are the editors of the new book, Big Business and Dictatorships in Latin America, a transnational history of profits and repression, published by Palgrave in 2021. This book, which we are talking about today, is an edited collection that includes the works of 19 researchers on the history of relations and workings between businesses and authoritarian regimes in Latin America. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much.
Thank you, Paula, for the invitation.
I already introduced you, but it would be great if you tell us a little bit about yourselves, a little bit more about your professional trajectory, your career.
Well, it's really great to be here. It's a pity that Hartmut cannot join us. Because the three of us combine, I think, very, very interesting trajectories to put together. In my case, I'm a labor historian, so I'm focused primarily on the history of the working class in Argentina and Latin America, and the changes of labor relations, also in relationship with technology and different processes of transformation. No? So in this book, it was very interesting for me to join Marcelo and Hartmut, who were mainly focused on business history and who looked at the issue from a different perspective. So, Marcelo, you can tell more about that.
All right. And yes, Paula mentioned, I'm in in business history mainly. And again, I mean, the combination of interests was crucial for the successful creation of this book. I have been studying Latin America for a while, and I have focused mostly on multinational corporations and their political strategies, but I have never touched this particular subject. So this is what I've been doing so far, and this is kind of like the natural next stage in my research.
So we can start with how this project came about. In the introduction, you explained that this book is the result of a meeting in Germany in 2016, where you discussed on corporations and authoritarian regimes. Can you tell us a bit more about how you, along with Professor Berthoff, came to coordinate this effort together?
Yeah, well, this is closely related to one aspect that I didn't mention before about my work, which is the relationship between research and the judiciary processes. For me, the Göttingen Congress was very interesting because it was trying to tackle this topic that the book tackles, which is not very widely analyzed for Latin America, which is the role of business in dictatorships. I focused on this dictatorships during the Cold War period in Latin America, and particularly in Argentina. And so the idea to join people from different parts of the world to discuss this, I think it was the main concern, the case of Volkswagen Brazil, that attracted a lot of attention because, of course, Volkswagen has a long history in terms of trying to come to terms with their past, with the involvement of this company with authoritarian regimes, and particularly the Nazi Germany. So this Congress was trying to build bridges and to connect this Nazi historiography, the historiography about the Nazi period in Germany, with the analysis of the role that companies played in dictatorships in the Cold War period in Latin America. So for me, being involved not only in history research, but also in ways in which we can deal with that in terms of policy and in terms of the process of truth and justice in Latin America, was very, very, very interesting. And I think it was a major step in making this book possible.
And adding to what Victoria just mentioned, the meeting in Germany was the result of an initiative of another scholar, a German scholar called Manfred Grieger, who was the official Volkswagen historian. And he was kind of like part of this whole a number of historians working for German corporations who are trying to come to terms with their past, with the Nazi regime. Now, one sad aspect about the meeting is that even though Professor Grieger counted with a lot of support from Volkswagen for the meeting, later on, a few months later, he had to leave Volkswagen because the firm didn't like some of his opinions and findings. So it showed the limits, even for corporations that are willing to open and be their past and be more transparent with their past. I mean, there is a limit for that. But this was the first step. Hartmut Berghoff is a world authority on business history of Nazi Germany. So this was a great combination. And not only that, but in the meeting we had, and in the book as well, we had the presence of several young scholars from Germany who are using archives that Latin American historians have not explored much and that have opened new ways of looking at the relationship between authoritarian regimes and big corporations in the continent.
So let's go into the book. And this connects with what you were saying, that you lay out nicely in the introduction, that in the case of Nazi Germany, historians, even though there are limitations, right, we do know a great deal about the arrangements and also the limitations of doing business under authoritarian regimes. So these two issues connected, business and authoritarianism, are also the frame that connects Latin American dictatorships, European dictatorships, and there are a couple of other mentions in there in your book, Egypt, South Africa. So this is the transnational frame, right? So what do readers and the public should know about how corporations, big corporations in Latin America, had a role in authoritarianism? How did they negotiate operations? How did they adapted? And sometimes even upheld dictatorial regimes. What is the big conclusion of the book?
I think before going to the conclusions, I think that it's very interesting to look at the scope that we had in the book, because I think it talks a little bit about how we could conclude a couple of things over there. In the book, we could include three pieces on Brazil, three on Argentina, a piece on Uruguay, two pieces on Chile, one on Peru, one on Colombia, one very interesting piece by Marcelo on Central America, and one piece trying to think about the financial sector in Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and Uruguay. So when talking about conclusions, I think we should say that the first step that I would try to emphasize regarding the book is that we had quite a big scope over there, and we could contemplate a number of aspects, both combining national overviews and general perspectives, and at the same time, particular cases, no? So we combine in the book the two main things, trying to understand how the relationship between military regimes and companies was in each of the cases, but at the same time, specific case studies about companies and economic sectors that illustrate some of the things. So I would say that this is the basis on which we can talk a little bit about conclusions. And what we see is this combination exactly. First, that this is a very important topic. I mean, when you talk about dictatorships in Latin America in the Cold War, you cannot omit the role of business, of the business community and business sectors in these dictatorships. These are not only military dictatorships, but in many ways, intellectual, ideological, but also very much institutional participation of business figures or leaders in policy making, and at the same time, business relationships, profits that business sectors and different companies earned during the dictatorships is an issue that you have to take into account. And at the same time, we saw that you have different time frameworks in these countries. Because I was mentioning different countries, and for example, the case of Colombia is analyzed for the 50s. It's not the same the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. No, the book has a very wide scope over there, so we can talk about different time frames. It's not the same the second stage of import substitution industrialization in Latin America that lasted until the 1970s. That the period of great transformation and the transition from Fordism to post-Fordism in the 60s and 70s and 80s, no? So what I would say is that the book confirms the key importance of studying business when analyzing dictatorships. It proves several ways in which business supported these regimes, provided funding, provided personnel, and established different kind of relationships with each of these military regimes. But at the same time, it proves the necessity of studying very complex and particular case studies. For example, in Chile, we know that there has been a very, very acute transformation in terms of economic policy and a very drastic transformation of the role of business and labor over there. This was also the case in Argentina, but with a repressive policy that had a different outlook. No, the disappearances and the number of disappeared and the way repression was deployed was different. And it was different than in Brazil, where the industrial development was not as severely interrupted as in the other cases. So I think the book wants to open a door, but definitely established the importance of this topic from this point onwards.
And if I may add to Victoria's point, but basically what we find is there was certainly a level of shared interests between many of the dictatorships in Latin America during the Cold War and big businesses, this was not a homogeneous situation. I mean, we all know that Pinochet in Chile, for example, opened the markets opened the markets and to competition with the countries in the rest of the world. But we don't find the same thing, as Victoria mentioned, for Brazil or the chapter of Uruguay shows as well. And the elites are not the same in each country and therefore pressured for different types of policies. Now, another thing that we need to remember from, one of the lessons of this book is that usually we focused way too much on American corporations in Latin America when it comes to right-wing military regimes and big corporations. The book brings here the role of German corporations, for example, the role of German foreign policy and the relationships with the military regimes in that area, and that opens another perspective. And there is a chapter that focuses on Canadian corporations. So it was not just American corporations and the coincidences many American firms would have had with Washington, but also other types of corporations coming from other countries. And the support came in many ways, from loans, kind of like the more legal, if you will, type of support to those regimes, to the other extreme that we find in several chapters of, for example, the case of German corporations, allowing the military to use their facilities to interrogate and to torture and disappear opponents of the regime. So we find a wide spectrum in terms of not only the origin of the corporations that were supporting the regime, but also the type of outcomes that the corporations wanted from these military regimes and the type of actions that they took in order to support the regimes.
Great. So why do we learn, for example, about what does it take to do business under a dictatorship? What do we learn about organization? Is right wing anti-communism, pro deregulation best for business? Is that something we can say, or what else? And what else can we learn?
Well, I think it's a very interesting question. I would say that one main thing, and I think it's connected with the different disciplines we are coming from too, and the dialogue that sometimes is missing between business history and labor history. What we learned is that even though there are different cases in Latin America, and you have different countries and different elites, as Marcelo was saying, and different working classes also, the roles of labor movements are different. We saw the concern of the labor regarding the labor movement as a central issue in all of the cases. I mean, it's not only profits, but also there's a concern about labor rights that it's very much present in this in all of the cases that we saw. It's very interesting that we could study in the book several automobile companies. Volkswagen, the case in Brazil, shows what you were referring to in terms of support and very public expressions regarding the joy of the dictatorship for some business sectors. No, they were greeting the change. They were even claiming that for this change to happen, because labor rights were very much a concern over there. No, the way in which they could restructure some of the changes that were happening. And we see the same in Argentina with the case of Ford, for example, or with the case of Mercedes-Benz, also two major multinational automobile companies that were studied over there. The case of Ford in particular is very interesting in Argentina because it shows very various connections that you were asking about, no? At the same time, you see a very close relationship in terms of investment. Ford was a major provider for the Argentine dictatorship. We see also a very close repressive connection, which was quite a surprise when studying this case, because there was a concentration camp, a detention center within the premises of the Ford company enterprise in Argentina, in Pacheco, in the province of Buenos Aires. So workers were held prisoners within the plant, and they were transferred to police headquarters and then to jails. No? So, and the connection with this was very, very clear because they used vehicles from the company. They received funding from the company, key information to detain the workers. And all this was the main subject of a trial in Argentina. So these cases about major multinationals, both in Brazil and in Argentina, show very clearly the different connections that we found in the cases of the military and business in Latin America.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And for the question of whether somebody would say, okay, so it's good for business to have a right-wing dictator. When looking at this under the perspective of these firms, what we find is in the context that in the Cold War context of those times, it looks like for most firms the arrival of a right-wing dictatorship was seen as a relief, as something that was stopping a movement that they felt was threatening their property and the very system under which they operated. Now, did they have to go? I mean, and now when it comes to the profitability of the operations, the chapter on the financial sector shows that it was, I mean, for the financial sector, I mean, of the Western world, it was a good business to have these dictatorships in those countries. For the corporations that were operating in the field, again, the idea, I mean, what has transpired from the archives studied by the different authors here is the sense of relief, and that they were kind of like doing that should be done. I mean, I'm in a country, I'm cooperating with the government against illegal groups. So whichever way was justified, this was what they were doing. And it's interesting, I mean, the fact that some corporations come from countries that are perceived in Latin America as less, I don't know, extreme in terms of their anti-communism, like West Germany or Canada. But, I mean, these were players also in the Cold War. And they found justifications to keep supporting their firms, despite sometimes internal opposition, especially for the case of Germany. And despite the fact that sometimes actual German citizens were killed by these dictatorships.
One thing that
that surprised me of this book is that there's not a lot of talking. I mean, not a lot of study or analysis of nationalization. So, you know, these foreign companies don't become, I mean, not necessarily become nationalized, which is what happened in other places, right, with dictatorships.
Because these guys were right-wing dictators. I mean, they were defending a system of markets. Now, let's remember, I mean, sometimes it depends. I mean, the military sometimes were more pragmatic than it's been acknowledged in terms of, I mean, in terms of their ideology. They could shift, I mean, the policy also based on their own interests. I mean, nationalization. I mean, we know that in Chile, Allende nationalized the copper industry, and in the great wave of privatizations, Pinochet did not touch the copper industry. He was more like, okay, now I have my business, I mean, or the business of the military, so I'm not giving this back to anybody. Mm-hmm. The American government did not care about Pinochet not giving this back. And actually, even the Chilean elite did not care. And so the chapter on Central America that I wrote also shows these shifting alliances sometimes of the military dictators. I mean, at some points, these right-wing guys allied themselves in Central America with the labor force against foreign multinationals when the foreign multinationals were not providing them with economic security. So then, I mean, it's not totally ideology driven, but sometimes, I mean, these military dictators came to power because their predecessors were either expropriating or threatening to expropriate.
Yeah, one exception maybe, because yeah, this is very, very important to stress. Now, all of the dictatorships that we studied here are mostly right wing and very much liberal in terms of economic positions, with the exception of the case of Peru.
Yes.
Where they studied two dictatorships, two stages, very different stages. And the first stage, led by General Velasco Alvarado, Juan Velasco Alvarado, from 1968 to 75, had nationalizations and had we could see as progressive of nationalistic measures, no? That then changed in 75 when there's another dictatorship very much aligned with the rest of the continent. But I would say that some of what you were asking, Paula, is related to this period of Velasco Alvarado, which is led by the military, which is a dictatorship, but at the same time has a progressive and nationalistic perspective. And in fact, Peru became a land that received many of the exiles of other dictatorships in Latin America at the same time in this period. And this changed in mid-1970s when a more right-wing dictatorship took power and implemented measures very much aligned with the rest. No, but even considering that they are mostly right-wing dictatorships, we do find different economic policies applied over there. And I think this specificity and the need to research and to contemplate specific cases and evolutions is very much confirmed with that, what we were discussing about Brazil and differences with Uruguay and Chile, and even the case of Central America, no, which is quite different. And we are talking about Latin America, but South America has some patterns and some connections, for example, the Condor plan and the coordination of the military dictatorships at this time. And this is, and the timing also is very much different from Central America. So we are dealing with a very complex and wide scenario to try to build generalizations about.
And I'm glad that Victoria reminded us of the chapter on Peru written by Martin Monsalve Zanatti and Abel Puerta Alarcón that shows how businesses adapted to the military dictatorship in Peru. That was a left-wing dictatorship, but they also showed that certain businesses did not necessarily oppose that dictatorship, partially in part because it was not even also like a radical It targeted certain industries, but not others, and in their expropriation policies. And this reflected also in the way the business community reacted to it.
Right. No, this is really interesting. And that's what the transnational framework, where it helps, right? It doesn't have to be the same, but it helps us see how complex this this process was. So actually, I was going to go back to this transnational framework, because there's another, and you, Victoria, you talk in your chapter about it, in your first chapter, and also Carlos Junes and Tomás Undurragas on the chapter on Chile, on how this ideology, the dominant economic thought of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, which is, neoliberalism, which is different, for example, from what, let's say, Franco Spain was, which is in the 50s and was very nationalistic.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting what you were saying, Paula, because I do think that another conclusion about this book is that we have to contemplate these different layers or dimensions. And is this way you can understand the connections between the military dictatorships in the 70s in Latin America and this neoconservatism, this neocons surge in the first world, no? And Reagan and Thatcher and the changes that took place in the 80s and 90s even. So there's a bridge over there, and I think it's connected with the idea that we are focusing mainly on dictatorships, but not only. I mean, these periods cannot be understood in isolation, but they have to be placed within larger narratives. And I think the changes in economic thought, which is something Marcelo contributed a lot to in the introduction, so he can pick it up in a second. I think it's very interesting to see how the transformations in economic thought and in economic policies have to be studied in the long run, no? And you have to connect these. So you were discussing the chapter by Carlos Huneus and Tomás Urumburraga is very interesting. It's one of the general perspectives that allow to understand the case of Chile in depth. And they show, and the case in Argentina, we show too, that you have to see how from the 50s and 60s, there were think tanks and networks trying to figure out what to do with these Keynesian policies and these import substitution policies that they were disagreeing with and the role of the state, and how the dictatorships helped a lot introducing these major intellectual figures and this business. Their connections with business sectors too, into economic policy. And then you can understand the transformations, the very strong transformations that took place, for example, in Argentina and Chile, different from those in Brazil and Uruguay, for example. But you do see a trend towards neoliberalism, and you see the role that these dictatorships played in this process. No, I think this is very interesting, and it's important. Because when you talk about dictatorships, it seems that you are discussing only the role of the military, no? And you have to talk about the armed forces. And this book brings about other characters in this story, and they show that if you don't have funding and if you don't have support from key players in these economies and societies, it's very difficult to carry on with such a project. Only with taking into account these characters and these other very important leaders that participated in this process, you understand the magnitude and the depth of this process, I would say.
Well, I think this summarized very well the main ideas. And but again, yeah, the heterogeneity of the processes is very important, and we cannot forget that the military tended to be nationalist, and they're usually seen as sellout, but at the same time, I mean, part of what they were doing was they were thinking, the way they sold this project was that they were fighting a war. against a foreign-supported forces. And yeah, there was a lot of corruption, of course. But I mean, this is part of like the resources that they thought they needed for this. And again, as the archives of some of our authors show, the companies themselves felt that they were at the in the front lines of this Cold War.
I saw, and we did talk about multinationals, but it's not only foreign companies working in Latin America or operating or letting governments use their facilities to for forced labor and prisoners, but also in the case of Brazil, for example, this construction company, it was operating abroad, right? And so how much do we care about the government or the country of origin when we let companies operate in our countries?
Yeah, totally. I think what you were just talking about is the connections that we started to find. I think this is a very important contribution of the book, which is trying to understand, not to compare, not to draw general and definitive conclusions, because it's not the place of this book, which is trying to open a field. So that's why we are tentative and we are very careful with generalizing. But I do think that this underlines the case for the importance of connections in this. No? For example, you don't think about the relationships between Brazil and Paraguay. And there are a lot of connections. I mean, not only they are neighbors, but Paraguay was very much influenced by Brazil. And there's an expansionism on the part of Brazil towards Paraguay, which is normally not seen. What you're saying about the chapter about construction by Pedro Campos, which is a very, very interesting piece of research. And it opened a lot of important contributions about groups such as Camargo or such as Odebrecht, which are very interesting today in Brazil. They show one major characteristic of some of the dictatorships of the region, which was the major infrastructure plans. No? And this is also illustrated by the dam, but the case of the dam, the Tucuruí Dam, also in Brazil, also studied in the book, which I think shows another phase of what Marcelo was saying. No, they have this nationalistic outlook. It's a very authoritarian nationalistic perspective that gives a very subsidiary place to the labor movement and wants control over society as a whole. But big construction works are a major topic that appeared and reappeared over there, and that has to be taken into account. And I think it's a line of research that allows to see these connections that you see. No, Ford, of course, is a multinational company. We see the growth in Argentina and the benefits at this time, but also in connection with its global scope as a company. No, and the same with Mercedes-Benz, and the same with, I don't know, the transformation of the copper industry in the period and the role of Madeco, studied by Joel Stillerman in the case of Chile. And there are a lot of connections, I think, between these processes that could not be explored before, and that we are making progress towards that.
And one thing about the country of origin that Paula was mentioning beforehand, we know that in the last few years, there's been a lot of interest and even celebration of the so-called multi-Latinas, like these multinationals from Latin America. The book also reminds us that some of these multi-Latinas have their origins in military or militaristic projects. And that for the dictatorships, I mean, these nationalistic dictatorships wanted and sometimes needed certain type of corporations to be really strong. I mean, the infrastructure, the aircraft, the computer industries, for example, in Brazil. The chapter on Chile, I mean, mentions also elements around the wine industry, and the copper industry as well. I mean, how certain policies permitted the take off of these corporations when these countries decided started to open themselves to the international competition. So there is the story of the multi-Latinas has also this side, in many cases, that needs to be taken into consideration.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, the continuity of these businesses once, you know, the dictatorship is gone or there's another regime in place. And actually to talk, you know, linking that to this, to the method of network analysis, which is in a few chapters of the book, which I think is really interesting. But they show, you know, that about how these relationships of the business community, they are lasting, and they kind of go beyond ideology. They go beyond maybe even administrations, right? These social relationships more than profits is what it's maybe sometimes what we should be looking at more than you know, being profitable, for example.
Exactly. There was a political project behind many of these corporations.
Right. Can you talk a little bit more about this this network analysis methodology that is chapter 6, From Business Associations to Business Groups, by Martin Monsalve, Sanati, and Abel Puerta. Alarcón, also the financial, the banking on the Southern Corn dictatorships, and big business and bureaucratic authoritarianism in Uruguay. They all have this network analysis research, which I thought was really great to bring in.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that started being used for Latin American studies relatively recently. And basically, I mean, with the type of sources that we can count on, it is possible through qualitative sources to create, to conduct this type of analysis. And this is particularly useful to see how the elite connected itself with the government or with other corporations, or how the elite also evolved and changed itself. I mean, here we find, for example, for the case of Peru, how these business associations eventually became business groups as part of a strategy to protect, quote-unquote, themselves from the left-wing military regime. And for the case of Uruguay, the chapter shows very, by Juan Bogliaccini and his associates, the case shows clearly why these connections allowed the Uruguayan industrial sector to survive throughout the dictatorship, in which, in a way, it got the quote-unquote good things of the dictatorship in terms of fighting against the left without forcing them to open themselves to international competition.
Yeah, and I think it's very interesting within the book, the coexistence of different methodologies and sources. As Marcela was referring before, we have some German authors that could access some of the business archives in Germany, which is something that we generally do not have in Latin America. I mean, and this is something to underline. I mean, business archives in Latin America are not widely open. In general, they are completely restricted, and particularly for the period of the dictatorship. So we do have a combination of statisticals from states. We do have the combination of published sources, the sources coming from business confederations in Latin America, unions. We have trade union archives that have been used as a source. We have public archives in Argentina, for example. There are intelligence archives from Argentina, but also some other archives, such as the NSA, the National Security Archives in the US, have been a source for some of the pieces. So we do have a methodological strategy to try to tackle what in Latin America is a very serious problem today, which is that business do not open their archives. So now would be also a good moment to ask for companies to release access to historians, because I think it's there in these organic archives with correspondence and memos, internal memos, and the folders of each of the employees, and a lot of different files regarding the functioning of the business in Latin America. They are very valuable sources that are sometimes available in the main headquarters in Germany or in the US, sometimes not completely available for this period, but are lacking for this field.
And this is, if I may add again, regarding the network analysis, this is a wonderful way by which researchers can overcome this lack of archival access. Because, I mean, some of these network analysis can be conducted with information that can be taken from directories, from annual reports, from, I mean, relatively open, I mean, even from newspapers. Like, I mean, who's a member of this club? Who's the cousin of this person? And this is, I mean, these are sources that, again, can, I mean, these authors very skillfully used as a way to overcome also the lack of other types of internal documentation.
I always end my interviews talking about the research process. And I think your book, I mean, this book, all the authors in your book show how to get to business through different sources that are not necessarily business records, because they are closed correctly. I mean, and so I wonder if part of the corporate responsibility programs that corporations have should include, you know, archives transparency.
I think it should be decisive. I think it's very necessary. I would say that also in some of the cases, the processes related to the memory, truth, and justice processes in each of the countries, yes, judiciary sources. In Argentina, for example, some of the companies have been forced to hand over their papers just because they are accused of having participated in the dictatorship, so they have to provide some evidence regarding that. And some of the sources we have come from this, from the judiciary to forcing companies to hand over their papers. I think it would be a very interesting issue to try to analyze the issue of business and human rights, having taken into account the issue of history. I mean, the process does not start right now. It's not from now onwards, but we do have a history that has to be dealt with. So I would say that your proposal, Paula, of including this request is not only very, very bright, but urgent as well.
But at the same time, I mean, I don't want to be the spoiler here. Let's remember also the effort was made in Germany, and it looked like a model to follow until some corporations started thinking, okay, you guys, you historians are going way too far. Sometimes, I mean, it's also, I mean, when they're forced to open their archives because of some judicial order, I guess, I mean, it's more trustworthy, I mean, whatever the researcher is going to find.
I was reminded again to the chapter on construction companies in Brazil by Pedro Enrique Pedreira Campos, because, you know, I just think about this huge infrastructure projects, and those are already, you know, part of our sources, right? I mean, these sources were this infrastructure projects were built under very specific circumstances and political context that should be told.
Yeah, and they are related to ecological problems, dealing with original communities that were there and in many cases were displaced and in many cases were repressed to build these giant infrastructure works. So you do have economic and social transformation should be analyzed in connection with repressive policies and political aspects. No? When you think about dictatorships, it's very important to think about all these social forces coming together, and of course, with specific constellations and relations. This is something that we cannot stress enough. No, you do have to do your research very carefully and specifically, but taking into account as many variables and dimensions as possible, I think. And this was a very important aim of this book.
Well, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you, Paola.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you to our listeners of the New Books Network. This is the Economic and Business History Channel, and my name is Paula de la Cruz Fernandez, and I hope you listen to this channel again.